Welcome to this episode of the Pharmaceutical Executive Podcast. My name is Miranda Schmalfus, Group Social Media Editor for Pharmaceutical Executive. This week, I'm joined by Fran Gregory, Vice President of Emerging Therapies at Cardinal Health. Fran and I talk about how she entered the industry, she actually never saw herself working in, and what's going on in the cell and gene therapy space right now, how CAR T therapies have been gaining momentum. We dive into personalized therapies and how they've been gaining traction, what the foci for cell and gene therapy will be for the next 5 years, and a whole lot more. But first, a word from our sponsor, and I'll be right back with Fran.
Hey there, Andy Studnut, co-host of the Applied Clinical Trials podcast here. Check out brand new episodes of the ACT podcast every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10. And you can find past episodes plus much more by logging on at appliedclinicaltrials.com.
Hi, Fran. Thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
So did you always see yourself working in the pharmaceutical industry? What led you to where you are today?
Great question. Interestingly, I really did not see myself working in this field. In fact, in my first years of college, I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I'm sure that's a common theme among many young college students. But I ended up studying chemistry and physics kind of by default because these things came naturally to me, not really knowing where they would lead me. But that really did lead me to my interest in medicine and healthcare. My interest really was in this desire to understand how treatments impacted diseases at the cellular level and how those, you know, cellular level interactions could end up benefiting the outcomes of the patients who were impacted by these medicines. And even early on, much of my interest was kind of in that biologic space in the complex therapy arena. So really fitting in with what I'm doing now and really my entire career being committed to innovative therapies and kind of those cutting edge newer treatments that are heavy in research and development and then really paving the way once those products come to market and helping them find their way to patients ultimately.
So what are some recent trends that are in the cell and gene therapy space right now?
Oh gosh, this is an area that is evolving rapidly. A lot of things we're starting to see coming out in this space. Really starting out with the first CAR T cell therapies in 2017, this is where the market began with the two first products, Kymriah and Yescarta, launching right around the same time in late 2017. And then this was a really amazing time, you know, having been involved very closely with one of those products, seeing patients, you know, essentially cured from childhood and other types of cancers. It was really a game changer for patients and for the overall healthcare system. In the cell therapy space, we now have therapies for multiple myeloma, follicular lymphoma, acute lymphocytic leukemia, B-cell lymphomas, and the list kind of goes on and on. It's really, really exciting for these patients who really had no other options prior to these cell therapies emerging. We also sell cell therapies approved for the first time in endocrinology conditions with the diabetes type 1 treatment, among others. So really an exciting time for cell therapies. And then, you know, most recently, of course, we've seen some gene therapy and therapies emerge that I'll talk about in a moment. But this area has really evolved very drastically over the past several years. Really exciting time for gene therapies. The first gene therapy followed, the first cell therapies in 2017 with Luxturna's approval in retina disease, which, you know, I think it was an interesting place for gene therapies to begin, right? In retina disease versus some of the other conditions that we saw very prevalently with cell therapy. So very different area of treatment. And then several additional therapies in the gene therapy space have followed, impacting conditions like hemophilia, beta thalassemia, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, among others. Most of these are relatively rare conditions. So the trends that we're seeing in this space are really impactful one-time treatments that are intended to treat relatively small populations of patients, anywhere from, you know, we've heard clinical trials having a hard time recruiting even 10 patients up to maybe, you know, a few thousand patients. The most recent news, obviously, with new approvals in the gene therapy space for sickle cell disease. This is a much more common condition, which affects approximately 100,000 people in the U.S. There are two different therapies that have been approved in this space, one being Lyfgenia and the other being Casgevy. And the first that I mentioned there being the first CRISPR therapy, which is a gene editing mechanism of action, first approval in the US for that product as well, or for that mechanism as well. So really, I think some of the trends we're seeing is that we're broadening the breadth of conditions that these treatments can, you know, impact. And we're also seeing new mechanisms of action emerging even within the cell and gene therapy typical mechanisms that we've seen. So it's a very exciting time.
Absolutely. Sounds like there's just growth all over the place. Can you tell me about how CAR-T have been gaining momentum and what kind of progress you expect to see from that kind of therapy, maybe within the next 10 years or so?
Yeah, sure. CAR-Ts, I view as kind of being the pathway pavers for cell and gene or innovative therapies across the world. And they've been highly beneficial to patients who have received them, as I mentioned previously, really curing conditions in some cases for patients. So really life-changing. They've had response rates and significant durability. So some of these patients are seeing, you know, long-term benefit from the treatments, even if not cured, you know, months, if not years of remission from the cancer that they've been treated for. Most CAR-Ts, as we discussed also, are for hematologic cancers or blood cancers, with a number of indications and those growing every day. If you look at the pipeline, though, very exciting. Three, you know, at my last count, this is an estimate, there are around 300 CAR-Ts in the pipeline in various phases of research and development. So we're starting to see more of the allogeneic products coming closer to commercialization, meaning that, you know, maybe we'll see the cost decrease a little bit, more patients can be treated, and possibly the logistics won't be quite as complex as some of those autologous products that we're seeing more prevalently in the market right now. So some of the interesting indications that we're seeing in these pipeline products are more broad cancer types, such as solid tumors. So we see some indications for pancreatic, colorectal, and breast cancers, among others. And we're also seeing some interesting neurological treatments, immunology, and of course, additional blood cancers or hematologic conditions as well. So very broad again, the CAR-T cell therapy space is, again, kind of was the first to come to market, and we'll continue to see it in increased innovation in this area. So excited to see what will continue to come with CAR-Ts.
Kind of shifting gears here. At PharmExec, one of the biggest trends that we've been hearing about and seeing currently is personalization, right? And I don't think it gets much more personal than the treatments in this space. So how are advances in gene editing contributing to that? And what can we do right now?
Yeah, this is a really interesting area. And I agree, cell and gene therapies are about as personal as our current medicine options come. These treatments are designed for one individual patient. When we're thinking about the autologous treatments, they really are using that one patient's own cells as the starting material to manufacture the medicine. So these patient cells are actually being shipped to a manufacturing site and turned into the medicine to treat these debilitating conditions. So that is, you know, a very personalized treatment, obviously. However, it does create some challenges and some barriers in this space. And, you know, something that I think is really exciting when you think about the future, even what we're seeing now, again, with that new CRISPR therapy being approved, some of these gene therapies are really addressing a very small part of the genome and, you know, really making edits to that small part of the genome, either by removing it or changing it or modifying that faulty part of the genome in some way. And, you know, these gene therapies right now are incredibly specific to these genomic mutations or faults, and really therefore can only address a very small population of patients, which is why, you know, we mentioned previously, a lot of these indications for these cell and gene therapies are very, very niche, and very small populations can be impacted by them, because especially in the case of gene therapies are indicated to treat, you know, sometimes very, very specific mutations that are really impacting a very small part of the overall genome and therefore a small population. But if you look at, you know, what is developing is, you know, what we're calling gene editing platforms that may really change that narrow focus. So if you think about more of a platform application to a treatment that can almost modify different parts of the gene based on how it's kind of programmed to go into that cell and modify the genome. So it's almost thinking about it from a much broader perspective. You're looking at an approved, maybe an approved platform that can be modified for one patient versus another patient to really impact a very specific, maybe different part of the genome for one population of patients versus another, but the mechanism still being very much the same. So when I look at kind of, you know, the science that's emerging and some of the educational sessions I'm listening to and hearing, I'm very excited by the thought of a much broader application that gene therapies could potentially be used for in a much broader population of patients who could benefit from these treatments if we can, you know, look at it from a slightly different perspective than how we do today in really thinking about the platform versus the individual gene therapy treatment kind of perspective. So very exciting times, again, evolving and still, you know, in research, a lot of these areas and these ideas, but certainly something that I think will continue to develop and eventually come to market.
That's fascinating. Like shipping the cells, that's all very, very fascinating. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Absolutely. It's all fascinating. I agree. Very interesting science.
So what do you think is the biggest hurdle within cell and gene therapy? And maybe how would the industry begin to jump over it?
As with any, you know, new innovation or anything that's new to market, whether it be, you know, technology or fashion or food or anything, there are challenges to overcome. You know, if you think about something new, people don't know what to do with it. They don't know they need it. They don't know how to handle it. They don't know how to treat it. They don't know how to process it. And a lot of this is education, you know, and just becoming educated about what it is that we're working with here and what the opportunities are when we think about these, again, these amazingly life-changing products. So, you know, when I think about the challenges and how we overcome them, I kind of think about the beginning kind of to the end. And, you know, the first thing is patient diagnosis and identification is a real challenge. When you think about sickle cell disease, this is considered a disease that impacts a somewhat underserved population of people, which makes it really challenging for those patients to have access to the appropriate level of care that they might need in order to even just get diagnosed with their condition. So not only being diagnosed, but being identified for a clinical trial is another challenge. So really thinking about how does a patient get enrolled in a clinical trial when they can't even possibly get to a physician who is able to diagnose and treat their condition in the first place. So huge challenges that patients face that, you know, not a lot of us think about every day, but it's very, very real in the lives of some of these patients who really don't have resources that would give them access to the type of healthcare that they need. So I think patient advocacy groups come into play here, and innovation with technology, I think, is really important. There's a lot of, I know AI is a big term out here, and I think that there is a huge opportunity to use artificial intelligence within EMRs to identify patients who could potentially be candidates for clinical trials. So again, this is an area of evolving innovation as well. AI itself, how do we use it? How do we optimize it? But I do think we're making some progress with AI in clinical trial recruitment and patient identification. So that's one thing. And kind of one of the ways, or a couple of ways, where we might start to kind of overcome or jump over that hurdle. The second one that I'm seeing a lot of is manufacturing and scalability. So, you know, I mentioned previously that right now, most of the products or many of the products require the patient's cells to be extracted from their body in a pretty complex process and shipped off to the manufacturer to be made into medicine. That's a very, it's an intensive, complex process that requires a number of steps and a number of costs. So if you think about that being a barrier, I think when we think about future products, we'll be more off the shelf, you know, and off the shelf is kind of a word for a cell or gene therapy that does not require the patient's cells, but that can be made from either donor cells or other biologic products. So those products could potentially be manufactured much easier or more efficiently because they don't require the patient to donate the cells to the process. So that's another area where we can start thinking about overcoming the hurdle of manufacturing and scalability. And then also, you know, just efforts to improve the manufacturing efficiency overall. So right now, these processes being very new to manufacturers, there are a number of, you know, outsourcing models that are being employed to improve manufacturing and really, that chemistry, manufacturing and controls that are very important to making sure that the product gets manufactured in the correct and most safe way. Improving those processes and creating efficiencies around those processes are a huge, huge initiative and a huge focus for the manufacturers and developers of these products. So I think we have a long way to go there too, but I think we are headed in the right direction, knowing that that is an area where we need to focus and continue to innovate and improve. The next thing that I would mention is, like I mentioned, kind of the broad application of the science, moving kind of from that single product to more of a platform-based product offering. This science and the research is moving really quickly in this space. And I think, we're just going to continue to see it evolve before our eyes, where we're going to see right now single product for single patient. And we'll continue to see that science moving way beyond that. And hopefully in the future, we'll be able to be so much more efficient and address so many more patients and people with debilitating conditions through this technology. One more thing, the patient experience. So I mentioned, some patients don't have access to the level of care that they need or deserve. So limited access to treatment, not only diagnosis, but also many of these products are available through what we call certified treatment centers. And many of these certified treatment centers are in metropolitan areas where there are large academic centers and experts in these conditions and treating these conditions. Many people don't live near those centers. So actually accessing a treatment center that is certified to administer these treatments can be a very significant challenge as well. Patients often have to travel to get to these treatment centers, and oftentimes in the case where they're required to donate the cells and go through other processes prior to receiving the infusion or the administration of the product, they can be required to stay in the hospital for a number of weeks or even months. And then next, also adverse event management. As these treatments become more and more sophisticated, I think we'll see less adverse events. But with the CAR-Ts themselves, for example, we're very used to seeing a certain set of adverse events that physicians thankfully are very good at treating and managing at this point. But I think as these treatments evolve and emerge, we'll see fewer and fewer adverse events as we hone in on more sophisticated and more precise treatments. And then finally, I guess one more thing. You cannot speak about these products without talking about the price tags, right? I think the most recent we looked at these products, on average, we're at about $1.5 million per gene therapy. Again, on average, that could go up or down depending on the day and what gets approved. Cell therapies are a little bit lower, being in the hundreds of thousands versus the $1 million range, but regardless, very high cost products. I think, when you think about the price, there are a number of pieces that go into that. Number one being kind of that payer access and making sure that the payer is going to pay for these medications, that your insurance provider is going to have a policy that, accepts the payment of these products and the administration of these products through their benefits. And the patients still may have financial barriers. So making sure those patients can access any programs that are available to them that might support them financially, whether that be through foundations or through the manufacturer themselves. And then I think one of the most interesting areas that is really important when we think about the value that these medicines deliver is keeping track of the outcomes, right? Measuring, did the patient have the outcome that we expected? Did the patient experience the durability that was seen in the clinical trial? Was that patient experiencing the same type of durability and the same type of outcome and, potentially the cure that many, many patients hope for? That these medications are, we hope that they will deliver, and really measuring those outcomes and elevating the story around the value. So if these patients have been experiencing hospitalizations every month for the last 3 years, and this product might cost $1.5 million, is this product actually a much better deal than what they were experiencing financially previously? And many of us believe that these products are actually very, very much worth it from a financial perspective and a patient outcomes perspective. So although the price tags seem high, when you compare those to the costs that these patients are incurring on a regular daily basis treating their diseases, that price tag might not seem so high after you evaluate some of those other factors. So I gave you a long list there. There are a number of challenges, but I also feel like so many opportunities. And I know there are so many of us working together to overcome those challenges every single day.
I think a common theme throughout those challenges, and you said it a couple of times, and it's what I want to get into next, is the topic and the, I guess, idea of patient advocacy. Because you're right, it comes down to the education, knowing where the centers are, knowing about the clinical trials. So with a big component of patient advocacy being educating the patient, providing them with the resources like those clinical trials, how has outreach changed in the past 5 years? And has there been, or maybe do you anticipate, an increase in using maybe social media to reach patients?
You know, patient advocacy groups themselves have evolved so much over time. Advocacy groups used to be really a resource for patients to find kind of camaraderie and commonalities with others who shared their condition and who shared kind of what they were going through, some of their challenges in daily life. And those advocacy groups have really evolved into very highly sophisticated organizations that support these patients, not only through that personal experience, but through the financial aspect, through clinical trial opportunities, and also through impacting even healthcare policy and payer policy. So I think that advocacy groups are an excellent resource, not only for patients, but for healthcare providers of all kinds to be aware of what advocacy groups are there and to help refer patients to those advocacy groups to help them find whatever type of support it is that they need. There are a number of advocacy groups that are really, really excelling in that clinical trial support. Sometimes it is a key offering that those patient advocacy groups really exist around, is getting involved in clinical trials. So there are a number of different apps that have been developed where patients can go to the advocacy website, learn about the app, download the app, put in their personal information, and actually receive alerts when potential clinical trials that they might qualify for are available. So really leaps and bounds beyond what clinical trials used to be and enrollment used to look like, even, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. So really exciting areas where advocacy groups are getting involved in damn access to these patients that other healthcare providers may not have, because advocacy groups are free to join. They're online. Patients don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to pay anything. They don't have to be intimidated by a physician or a healthcare provider. They don't have to, you know, really take any risk. They can really join these advocacy groups or take part in some of the work that the advocacy groups do without feeling, you know, any kind of pressure to reciprocate or go to the doctor or spend money or, you know, really anything. And these advocacy groups help connect them with the level of support that they need or that they're looking for at what point in time that they're looking for that support. So I think those are some really important areas where advocacy groups get involved. And I think one of the things that I love about advocacy groups and that we've seen them really come to rise to the occasion on with Cell and Gene is that they kind of collate all the patients' opinions and voices, and they serve as one, you know, much louder voice that can really influence, again, healthcare policy, payer policy, and really help the overall political and healthcare environment take notice of this patient population and that they, you know, they deserve attention, they deserve resources, and they deserve the treatments that they need. So I think advocacy groups, again, have evolved leaps and bounds since even 5 or 10 years ago. And I think they'll continue to evolve to support patients and support the healthcare system and help improve efficiencies that we see in patients accessing the care they need. The other thing that's interesting about advocacy groups is some of them work with the FDA, and they help get patient voices included in FDA advisory boards or other FDA meetings where the FDA could be potentially making a decision regarding approval of a product or not approval of a product. And they like to hear from patients, and patient voices are often kind of sponsored by these advocacy groups and can really help when the FDA is reviewing those products. They really do want to know how the patient views the treatment, what their experience has been, and they do take that into account when approving these products for very rare diseases. So a lot of different areas where advocacy groups can really help elevate these patient populations that need these products and treatments.
Absolutely. And amplifying the patient voice and supporting them more, I think, helps build that ever so important level of trust between patient and physician, patient and industry. It's an ever going balance, I guess you could say. But to help strengthen that relationship, I definitely feel like patient advocacy groups, they help do that.
Absolutely. It just creates that awareness of what these patients are going through and almost an immediate respect for what they need and how we can help them as healthcare providers. Definitely agree.
Many cell and gene therapies, as you know, are being developed for rare diseases with specific genetic mutations, hoping to help patients that previously had untreatable conditions. So that's huge. Can you tell me what kind of progress there's been in that space?
Yeah, sure. I spoke a little bit to that with, you know, the CRISPR gene therapy that was approved for sickle cell disease. And, you know, one of the things that I always say, being a pharmacist in the innovative therapy space, whether it, you know, be 20 years ago or today, is it's amazing when these products come to market or you're researching them in the pipeline. Some of these conditions you never knew existed. So as a pharmacist or a physician or a healthcare provider, you have to figure out what that condition is and learn about it. Learn about the treatment, learn about the medication, the mechanism, and the science behind it so that you can help educate others. So you really get to see firsthand how quickly these things are evolving and how little we know about the healthcare environment that we serve as healthcare providers. So it really is humbling when you think about some of these products that, you know, have been approved in the past and will be approved in the future for conditions that affect extremely small populations of patients and very, very rare genetic mutations that are being addressed by these gene editing or other gene therapies, and how much we have to learn. So I think when you look at the progress we've made to date, some of these medications that have been approved, again, for hemophilia and specific mutations in muscular dystrophy, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, very, very specific populations of patients are being impacted by those. And if you look at the pipeline, there are over 2,000 cell and gene and other innovative therapies we're waiting for, patients are waiting for. So many previously untreated conditions will be evolving in that pipeline as well. And, you know, my role at Cardinal Health and, you know, being a healthcare provider in general is to make sure that I understand what's in that pipeline, what conditions are coming, how can we prepare the market, how can we prepare payers, providers, physicians, nurses, and even patients for these products that are coming in these conditions that really possibly no one's ever heard of. So I think there's a really unique opportunity to take advantage of the learnings that we can see and really prepare the market for what's to come. So I think it's a really exciting time in that pipeline. You know, we think about cell and gene as, you know, oncology. A lot of people affiliate cell and gene therapies with oncology or hematologic conditions. But, you know, when you look out into that pipeline, we see treatments in the cardiovascular space, endocrinology, retina conditions, as well as neurological conditions like Parkinson's, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, and others. So the future is bright. Right now, it is a very small market. It's pretty niche, but I think we're here to see this market really grow and expand into some areas that are going to be extremely impactful for large populations of patients.
So we've talked about a list of challenges and hurdles, and we've talked about the rapid growth in the area. But I'm curious, what do you think will be the biggest foci for cell and gene therapy for the next 5 years?
I think we'll be surprised no matter what we think we'll see. I'm sure we'll see innovation that will just absolutely surprise us and continue to amaze us and wow us as we move into the future. But right now, if I had to, you know, kind of think about what I would expect, is I think we'll see continuing focus on products that are more off the shelf. And when I say off the shelf, meaning, you know, they don't need those patients' individual cells for manufacturing. So either, you know, allogeneic products or products that are gene therapy products that can kind of be that, you know, platform-based product that can impact more segments of the genome or a larger population of patients. So fewer products that require patient cells and that patient, you know, kind of that intensive patient process going through donating cells and preparing them for infusion, moving on to more of an off-the-shelf type of product and manufacturing. Second thing, maybe more focus on manufacturing scalability and efficiencies. You know, I think we all are seeing the manufacturing processes are extremely complex, extremely challenging, and, you know, really one by one manufacturing is very difficult to scale. So I think we'll see more focus on manufacturing scalability and efficiency. And, you know, hopefully that will lead to prices potentially becoming more manageable or a little bit lower due to those efficiencies and larger manufacturing scalability, so that we can really ensure that the patients who need these treatments can access them. The third thing I would say, more attention on those platforms that I mentioned versus the individual gene being altered by one therapy. So potential changes, and you know, I would not promise this, but I think, you know, some of what I'm hearing is just more openness to the way that the FDA views products in the gene therapy space and evaluating products, you know, maybe on a broader scale. And again, thinking about those platforms versus individual treatments for individual gene editing or gene modification. So again, I will claim not to have a crystal ball at all in that, but I'm just hearing so much in that space that it seems inevitable that we'll move towards something more efficient in that area. And then finally, I think one of the most interesting thing from a clinical perspective is I think we'll see additional focus on the outcomes and the financial risk sharing between the parties involved. So, you know, again, going back to that patient experience, and did they get the outcome that they expected from this treatment? In clinical trials, we see certain response rates, we see certain durability rates. Are those same rates that we see in clinical trials translating into real life for these patients in the real world? Does real world evidence support that? And what is the value associated with that? And, you know, we call this risk sharing or outcomes or value based agreements between providers and manufacturers, or payers and manufacturers. So I think we'll continue to see a push for some financial risk sharing between some of the parties involved in cell and gene therapy and these treatments in the future as well. So those would be my key things if I were to, you know, kind of think about what I would expect to see in the future. And again, I'm sure I'll be humbled and surprised with things as they continue to evolve.
Well, predictions are just predictions, but I appreciate your insights very much and your insights throughout this entire podcast. I've really learned a lot, and I feel like there's little nuggets of information that every listener is really going to be able to take away from this. So Fran, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a fun conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd love to be able to have a conversation sometime in the future. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Awesome. Thanks again.
Take care.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the PharmExec podcast, where we take you behind the headlines to provide expert tips from industry leaders. Remember, you can always find us on the web at pharmexec.com, on Twitter at PharmExec, and on Instagram at PharmExecutive. The views on this podcast do not reflect those of MJH PharmExec's parent company or our advertisers. For editorial questions or to get in touch with our editors, please email us at pharmexec@mjhlifesciences.com. And for sponsorship opportunities, please go to pharmexec.com/advertise. Thanks again for joining us, and we will see you next time.